Members of this honorable court, my name is Pat Simic. I'm from Lubbock, Texas. I'm here on behalf of the petitioners on their application for writ of error. The subject, in simple terms, which we are asking the court to review is adoption of parental one community. Some history, just briefly, this suit is...
You would speak a little louder for some of the older members.
Yes, sir. I'll be happy. This suit is for damages. It's brought by three children of their father against the father for injuries they sustained in an automobile collision in Clay County, Texas. This collision occurred on June 29th of 1985. The children's names are Waka, Ahmad, and Sahir, and they bring this suit through their mother and their next friend, Tawar Jalani. The suit is against their father, Ahmad. In their suit, they allege that injuries were caused to them by the negligent operation of a motor vehicle by their father. The basic facts are set out in the brief. Essentially, the car was traveling down a roadway. The car lost control, the driver lost control of the car, overturned, striking a pole, and causing injuries. I don't believe the issue of negligence is disputed at all.
Counsel, before you move from the facts, is the issue that they were on vacation controverted, or is that conceded that they were on vacation or recreational, some sort of recreational activity?
Your Honor, I believe it's conceded that they were on a trip. I think there becomes a question as to whether or not vacation is recreation or recreation is vacation. For purposes of our argument,
does it make a difference from your argument?
I don't think it makes a difference, Your Honor, at all. But with respect to that particular question, I think the depositions said that they were on a trip. I think the father said that they had a vacation and they took a trip to see friends. It doesn't say we were on vacation to see friends, but that's the way the language came down in the briefs. With respect to this particular case, the suit was filed in Hopley County. The court, trial court, heard a motion for summary judgment, granted that motion for summary judgment. The case was appealed to the 7th District, where the case was affirmed, and it's here on the verdict. Petitioners are asking this court, in this case, to abolish the doctrine of parental immunity in cases where injuries are sustained by children because of the negligent operation of a motor vehicle by a parent.
You're just asking for that narrow relief, only as to motor vehicles and nothing else that would affect the parental immunity doctrine.
That's correct, Your Honor. I think as we discuss and go through the argument, it will become clear as to why, in this particular case, we're only asking the court to abolish the doctrine of parental immunity in motor vehicle collision cases and not as whole. The court chooses to do that, that's the court's decision, but in this case, we're restricting it to motor vehicle cases. With respect to this parental immunity doctrine, there is an abundance of case law that is in our state and other states. There is abundance of judicial law that is in our state and other states. There is public policy considerations. There are legal and moral obligations and plain simple justice. I submit the quest and ask this court to abolish this archaic doctrine. A little history may be helpful to emphasize the points that I'm trying to make. Parental immunity was first recognized almost a century ago in 1891 in a court in Mississippi in a case called the Hewitt case. That case was not a motor vehicle accident. It was a case where a child brought suit against the mother for basically false imprisonment because the mother put the child in an insane asylum. The court in the that case in Mississippi, saw no judicial decisions with respect to this, had no law, but in the interest of preservation of the harmony of the family, peace and tranquility, held that, and I submit, without any public policy, without any authority, just public policy grounds, held that a parent's obligation to care for, guide and control the child, and the child's obligation to comfort and obey, and the whole idea of peace and harmony dictated that a child not be permitted to sue the parent. Following this decision, a number...
Before you leave that, are there any policy reasons for changing that particular rule of the Mississippi court in the false imprisonment case? Do you think of any reason for that, why that doctrine should be changed in, under those facts?
In a negligent operation of motor vehicle, I think there are a lot of policy reasons, John.
Well, no, I didn't ask you that.
I'm sorry.
Do you see any reason to change the outcome of that particular case in modern day because of changed conditions?
That to change it in modern day, yes, I do see reasons to change it.
You would permit a child to sue a parent for false imprisonment?
No, I didn't say that, Your Honor.
I'm sorry. I thought you said you would change the result of that case.
I would change the philosophy of that case. And the philosophy that I understand that case is about is that a child cannot sue a parent for any reason, not just false imprisonment. I think that case was all inclusive. I do not believe that in modern society that is appropriate, and I believe the courts have recognized that.
Go ahead.
Thank you. Our first real look at parental immunity doctrine occurred in the Abusi case in 1954. And in that case, which surrounded a child having a hand injury in a store where it came in contact with a fan, father was a partner in that store, the court adhered to the basic rule developed in the Hewitt. And that was, and it stated that the peace and tranquility of the home and the best interest of minor children will be conserved by following the general rule that an unemancipated minor cannot sue his parent for damages based on acts of ordinary negligence. Following this case, this court had the opportunity to look again at the parental immunity doctrine in 1971 in the case of Felderhoff v. Helter Felderhoff. Again, this was not a motor vehicle collision case. It was a case where a young man with a young son, unemancipated, was working for his father's business, and his father turned on to come by and caught the son's auger in his hand. And the court, in reviewing the doctrine, recognized the child's right to sue for injuries caused by a parent by ordinary negligence, but it retained the immunity for liability for acts of ordinary negligence, which involve reasonable exercise of parental authority or the exercise of ordinary parental discretion. In that case, this court recognized that the plaintiff the plaintiff in that case had the same status as other employees of that firm, the only difference being that the child was a minor or unemancipated, and that he was under his father's supervision and his father was a part of that business. I would like to distinguish where I believe this case is different from Felderhoff, in that this is the negligent operation of a motor vehicle case, which calls into play other duties owed by a parent to society as a whole, and not limited just to the child and the exercise of parental discretion. It is our position that the negligent operation of a motor vehicle should not be classified as a reasonable exercise of parental authority or the exercise of parental discretion with respect to provisions for care and necessities of the child. We contend that in Felderhoff, the court recognized that a child may bring suit for negligence in certain cases, and that even in this case, where it involves the operation of a motor vehicle, the parental immunity doctrine and exception car. The court did not specifically address that, but its language indicates that the exception for parental immunity doctrine was being maintained for parental discretion, and parental authority was necessary to maintain the stability in that familial relationship.
Sir, isn't it also public policy and statute that the parents are responsible for the care and treatment and medical treatment of a child, so that the child, if he gets treatment, the hospital or the doctor can sue the father for the bill. Isn't there also that policy that the child is, public policy requires the parents to provide for their care and treatment, without the necessity of the child suing the father to recover for the care and treatment?
Well, I concur that the public policy requires and dictates that we as parents provide those necessities for our children. What I submit is that public policy dictates that we as parents, when we operate a motor vehicle, have a duty to everybody and not just our children. And it doesn't hinge on parental authority. It doesn't hinge on the provision of necessities. It's something aside and apart that each of us has.
Well, a child's judgment against the father is, he's required to provide the necessities for the child anyhow.
Yes, I understand.
If the child levies execution on the judgment, I guess the child and the father get put out of the house or something.
Well,
where does it end?
I don't believe that's totally correct, Your Honor. Certainly, if the child were to receive a judgment against the father, it brings into play the possibility of the child taking money from the father or from the father's household. I think it's relevant, and many, many jurisdictions have recognized that in our society, as we have evolved and as we have developed, and particularly in Texas, through the statutes that have been created, we have provided that, number one, all of us carry insurance to protect against those causes. In this particular case, the evidence is undisputed, and I think that becomes...
Well, then does that mean unjust enrichment? If the child gets a recovery from the father's insurance, then the father would be actually the person who would be in charge of the administering of the child's estate, wouldn't he?
That's correct, but I don't believe...
Then he's the wrongdoer, the negligent one.
Under those facts, yes, but I do not believe, Your Honor, under the discussion we have, that it would be unjust enrichment to the father.
But he would...
As a practical matter, the father pays for, and may have paid for years, that insurance to protect not only any stranger he may come in contact with, but anybody, including the relative, and I submit, including his own child. So I don't see that as unjust enrichment.
Are you saying that the recovery of the child should be limited to the amount of insurance which the father carries?
No, Your Honor, I don't believe I'm saying that. I think that is a decision for the members of the jury that hear the facts to decide what a child should be entitled to, if anything, against the father. And I think our jurors that we have in our courts today are sophisticated enough to make the appropriate decision to relieve in those cases.
But wasn't one of the distinctions made that the reason for allowing the child to sue the father is because the father carries insurance and he has a duty to everyone?
Yes, Your Honor, that's correct. And several courts have made that distinction. As I understand the various writings that have been made on the subject, is that as a matter of public policy, we carry insurance for protection. The fact that the insurance may cover all or only a portion is not material. It's the fact that the child should not be denied the same rights as others just because of the relationship between child and parent, that if the child is entitled to recover from the parent, whatever amount the jury sets would be the amount that would be determined. Whether or not the child, through his next friend, would choose to go beyond and attempt to execute on the judgment, I think it's a completely different subject, just as it is in any injury case where you receive a judgment. You may receive a judgment in excess of the insurance policies that are provided for others. Whether or not you can execute or go after other assets is a separate and distinct question.
If we were to accept your proposal for a cause of action, wouldn't it be an empty gesture in as much as the policy is now approved by the Texas Insurance Commission would not cover a parent in respect to a child. In other words, that's accepted from coverage now?
Under the current policies, that's my understanding. The contractual clauses provide for that.
And well, then what's the purpose for eliminating the cause of action prohibition in motor vehicle cases only, since you can see there's no applicable insurance? Wouldn't we just be handing down an opinion that would have no effect?
No, Your Honor, I don't believe it would.
It had a great effect on the next family's time that they sat down to dinner, wouldn't it?
No, I don't believe it would, Your Honor.
You don't think that the son or a child sitting there with $1 million judgment against his father, coming to the dinner table with the mother there who had sued his next friend, you don't think that's going to affect their relationships at the dinner table?
In all honesty, I don't believe it would.
Oh, come on.
That's my opinion, Your Honor.
If the child wants a bicycle, can't he just say, Dad, just give me a credit off the million that you owe me?
I guess you could. I don't think in reality that's what the child's going to say. Number one, the suit is being brought by the mother on behalf of the children, Your Honor. That decision has already been made. If there was injury to the familial relationship, I think it's fair to assume that that would have occurred in the past 2 years with the suit pending against the father. Secondly, the child at this point in time is acting through that mother, and the mother has made the decision to bring the lawsuit against the father for that negligent operation of the motor vehicle in this case. And if I may, I'd like to go back to Justice Garland's question about would it have no effect. Your Honor, first of all, it would have a profound effect in this case in particular, and that's one of the reasons that we're here. Secondly, there are a number of cases that involve this type of action where a child has been denied a right to bring suit against the parent. There are a number of cases, I submit, that are pending that may just simply be awaiting the turning of the child's majority to bring a suit. The judicial system recognized that the child is not prohibited from bringing a suit any more than a stranger if they're a minor. They can wait for the majority to bring it. So I think the decision of this court on this case has an effect on more than just this one case. I think it has it on others. With respect to the provision that has now been written in the insurance policy, I submit that things of that nature have occurred in other jurisdictions, and other jurisdictions have looked at those restrictions placed in policies, and there is a question as to the constitutionality of that, the restriction of the policies in those situations. I don't know what's going to happen in that area. I just simply know in this particular case, the minor child sustained fractured hips, a number of other things, required surgeries, incurred medical bills, and was brought suit against the father. And whether or not he's permitted to bring the suit affects this particular family.
The father refused to pay for those damages?
I'm sorry.
The father refused care for the child?
No, the father and the family still exist as a family unit.
The question is, if the father refused to provide medical attention to the child, if the father say, I'm not going to pay those medical bills, I'm not going to give you the medical care that you need.
The father provided the medical attention that he could within his main partner's
house. So why are we here?
Didn't pay enough, I suspect.
Well, I believe that's correct. Number two, the father could not and did not compensate the child for the injuries he sustained. He did not and could not compensate the child for the physical disability that remains, the problems that are still there, and that's why we're here.
Have you made a survey of how many states still have this doctrine with respect to automobiles?
Yes, Your Honor. The last survey I made showed a little bit over half have either abolished parental immunity in total, have carved out exceptions in motor vehicle accidents, have carved out exceptions in motor vehicle accidents where insurance coverage was applicable. I do not know the current number. The Supreme Court of Iowa, a recent decision this past year, and which is not cited in the brief, in Deal, D-I-E-H-L versus Deal, Supreme Court of Iowa in Lake Spring recognized the right of the father to sue a child, an unemancipated child, for injuries he sustained when the child injured him in a motor vehicle collision. And in that recognition, the Supreme Court of Iowa again reaffirmed its position that in a motor vehicle or negligent operation motor vehicle cases, there is no bar for a child bringing a suit against the parent, and that this is the movement of the courts across our land to change this archaic doctrine.
You've talked a little bit about insurance coverage, which I suppose we can take judicial notice of. The blanket umbrella liability policies, would they pick up this exclusion that's excluded out of the basic personal injury bodily liability insurance coverage in Texas?
I don't know if they would, Your Honor. I think it would depend on the individual policy. I would assume that if there was a personal umbrella policy that covered any acts of negligence of the party and did not provide an exclusion for suits by a child against their parents or the family relationship, that they would come into play. I think it's a practical matter, very, very few people can afford or carry any type of that coverage.
Yes. If there were insurance coverage, either under that scenario or because the insurance commission changed the standard Texas policy, do you see any problems of collusion or potential for abuse where the plaintiff and the defendant are essentially on the same side, particularly in light of some of this court's recent decisions greatly extending the ability of an insured to sue an insurance company for slow payment, non-payment, insufficient payment of claims?
Well, certainly I see potential, as that word definition implies.
Do you think that we should carve anything out, or we should just assume that that will happen so infrequently, or that if it does happen, juries in their wisdom can take care of it?
I don't think anything needs to be carved out.
I mean, you wouldn't change the Arnold Doctrine or make it inapplicable to this kind of case.
No, Your Honor, nor would I change the doctrine espoused from Christ with what's been stated to sneak. I think our courts have recognized that our juries are sophisticated enough to ferry out that our court system is designed that way through the system of justice we have, those points to be taken care of.
But if we applied your reasoning here, there would have been no recovery in Sneed, because that was not a motor vehicle accident. It was an airplane crash.
That's correct, Your Honor, but the similarities between Sneed and this are that in that case, the parent was operating an airplane. Again, not an exercise of parental authority or parental discretion. In this case, he was operating a motor vehicle. And I think that is a very important distinguishing point, and that is that the operation of a motor vehicle is a duty we owe to all. It's a duty that's regulated by licensing procedures. It's a duty that's regulated by traffic signs. It's a duty that's regulated by our law enforcement officers. It's a duty where we have to take a driving test. We've got mandatory insurance. In other words, it's something that applies to everything and everyone. The exercise of a parental duty, and that is telling your child he has to do one thing or the next, is completely different than a duty that's owed to all. A duty that's owed to the children that requires that special judgment as to how should I treat this child is one thing. To say that when you take the child in the car with you and you owe a duty to everyone is exercise of parental duty, I think, is to belie the truth of the matter. When we operate a vehicle, when we operate a plane, if we operate a boat, we've got to do everybody that's out.
Counsel, what you're saying is that if the father goes down the road with his own child and the neighbor's child can recover, but his own child can't.
That's correct.
His father's neighbor. So it doesn't really make any sense, does it?
It doesn't. Not only that, as the court knows, the wife can recover. If they've got a cousin in the car, they can recover. If their next friend's in the car, they can recover. Our law that exists today says if you're a child or a parent that causes injury, you may not recover because you're a child, because in 1891 a decision was made that all children could not recover. And what I'm saying to this court is that at this time, in our history, and in our land, and in our state, to deny the child the right that everyone else but him has is not justice, it's not equality, and it's not right.
Well, counsel, let's move on from that a little bit, because you know if we decide that issue in your favor, we're going to then have all these child abuse cases that will immediately go to the courthouse and come to us. That being an intentional tort, where are we?
Well, I think so.
And does the homeowner's policy cover it?
Again, I think it depends on the individual policy, Your Honor, but I think the court has already spoken to intentional torts and the right of the child to bring suit for those. And if it's child abuse and it's an intentional tort, the child is going to have that right. The child has the right to bring the suits in for contractual disputes. The child has the right to bring the suit against the parent for damage to his property. The child has the right to wait until he's 18 to bring the suit against the parent. The right the child does not have, as it exists today, is to bring a suit against the parent for ordinary negligence.
All right, if we allow, as we do, a suit against the parent for intentional conduct, what if the parent negligently inflicts and disciplines the child, negligently inflicts a permanent disabling injury? Now, I understand you that you would not allow recovery in that case because it didn't arise out of a vehicular accident.
No, Your Honor, I think what I'm saying, maybe I'm not saying it very well, is that I don't quarrel with the right and the duty of a parent to carry out the authority that is expressly theirs to carry out that concerns directly the discipline of that child, the rearing of that child, and those actions unless his conduct is of such a nature that it becomes intentional or something of that nature. And I think there's a distinct difference between a child that is harmed that way and a child that is harmed by the ordinary negligence of a parent, and in this case, I just singled out a motor vehicle accident, and the application of the child's right to bring a suit against the parent.
Why not the ordinary negligence of a parent in operating an airplane? Why shouldn't that be covered?
I think it should, Your Honor.
Well, if it should, then why are you asking only relief in motor vehicle situations?
Because the particular case that's at hand that I'm representing the people on pertains to a motor vehicle. As I stated earlier, I think a father or a mother operating not just a vehicle, but a plane, a boat, or any other thing where the exercise is a duty that he owes to everyone, then I think that ordinary negligence and a child should be able to bring suit against the parent for ordinary negligence in those cases. I leave the court's discretion, not only that, but particularly whether or not ordinary negligence in the discipline of children, i.e., you spank the child and the child ends up with a bruise, I personally see no justification for the child bringing suit. I think that is a necessity. I do see justification for a suit for the parent, not just the father. The parent's negligence causes injury in doing something that he owes a duty to the whole world and not just to that child. We've touched upon it, but as the court knows, decisions have been rendered by this court for the past 3 or 4 years that I think parallel the questions that are raised in the parental immunity doctrine, specifically Whitworth v. Bynum, the Sneed case, the Price case. In those cases, the court discussed at some length many of the old justifications, and I submit their old for the parental immunity doctrine, the peace and harmony, the collusive suits, the various aspects. I submit this particular case and cases of its same nature follow that line of reasoning, and that as such, the parental immunity doctrine should be abolished with respect to particular operation of motor vehicles.
When you sit down, be thinking of an answer to this question, because I'm going to ask you when you get back up, unless you are offering. This court has changed some of the rules of tort law in the last 5 years that you alluded to. But in each of those instances, we have cited changed conditions in society and in societal relations or in the economy that justifies such a move, and we've cited other states that have gone that same way. Now, you talked about half the states have abolished this immunity. What I'm going to ask you when you get back up here is what policy reasons exist today that did not exist back when that first case was handed down, I can't remember the name, but she referred to it and know which one it is. What changes in the family structure have changed that would dictate a change in the law with respect to this? You can answer that when you get back to it.
All right. Thank you, counsel. We're now ready to hear argument from respondent.
Next, please, the court, Mr. Furter, will present argument for the respondent.
May it please the court, my name is Tom Purdom, and I represent the father in this case, who is Ahmad Shalabi, and I have a long oration to give to you all, and I'm sure you're dying to hear, but I can see that you all are familiar with the case and have questions, and if it's all right with you all, I'd rather just let you all ask questions, and my response to them is best that I can. If we run out of something to do, I'll launch into my oration.
I have a question for you. One of the reasons for this doctrine was to preserve the tranquility of the family unit. Recognizing that nationwide we have a divorce rate in excess of 50%, and in many cities in Texas we approach a divorce rate of 60%, do you feel that one spouse bringing suit against the other spouse on behalf of the child will have any effect on the divorce rate in Texas?
I don't know about the divorce rate, but from the standpoint of, I was trying to figure out what could I say to you all that would bring it home as to what we're talking about here. To say that the child suing the parent has no effect upon the parent-child relationship is kind of like saying if a clerk of this court were to bring suit against this court or to testify against this court somewhere, would that cause disharmony among the court? And I think it's obvious that it would.
That must belong to part of the court.
Those kinds of things bring disharmony. I mean, it's just absurd to say they don't.
Would it depend on whether the member of the court that the clerk was suing was the real party in interest?
Yes, it would. And I think that's precisely what
it is. Would it matter if a member of the court that was being sued was insured?
Yes, I think it would.
And would you recommend that we have a direct action statute that allowed the real party in interest to be brought into the suit?
I certainly think that if you are going to say that we're going to allow the child to sue the parent because there is insurance, and that is the reason that you're allowing the suit to be brought, then most certainly the insurance company ought to be able to be represented.
Well, if you've got counsel, are you representing the father or the insurance company here?
I'm representing the father.
No insurance.
There is insurance, but under the Twilight case, I represent the father, and I recognize that duty and make no apologies for it. I represent the father.
Father is paying your fee.
No, sir.
Wouldn't all the arguments against the removal of this doctrine go out the window if we allowed the direct action by child against father of the insurance company?
Probably would, yes. But the same argument is made in this way. Not necessarily, that's not the only way to handle it. The way to handle it is to have insurance for this sort of thing, for the father to have insurance for this sort of thing. And he might have had in this case. We don't know. It's not a part of this case. All these medical bills may very well, and I expect probably were, covered by insurance that the father had. But it's not involved in this case.
Would it require, I assume it would require now a rewriting of insurance policy to cover members of the family, your passengers in the vehicle?
Well, there's a mandatory endorsement, which is automatically attached to all policies, and as I understand it, which would then would exclude any family member. Wouldn't apply in this case because the mandatory endorsement is not attached to this policy.
But in order for me to cover my children in my car, if I'm driving down the road and I negligently injure them, I now have to buy a rider that takes that exception out. Isn't that correct? Or well, can I even do it?
Well, I don't know what you can do. That's my only question. I'm not sure you can do it. I understand what you're talking about. I'm just not sure under insurance rules and regulations.
You're going to make me go and read my policy.
Let's get away from insurance for a minute and talk about the policies that this court sets, regardless of what other agencies of government are doing. At the time this doctrine came up in 1891, there were no automobiles. I mean, none that ran. There were lots of familial exceptions drawn into the law. In the last part of the last century, the first part of this century, all the guest statutes, a lot of those have been abolished, and petitioner runs through similar types of situations where family members can sue each other. How does this fit in? Should we change those others, that is, parents suing children, spouses suing each other? I mean, are those errors, or is this... how can you reconcile them?
Well, let me tell you, I think this is a different kind of situation. This is a situation where, well, there's only two possibilities, it seems to me, that you either have collusion between the parent and the child against, ostensibly the insurance company, or you have a conflict between the parent and the child. And you don't want to encourage either one of those. We don't pass this collusion.
I mean, the collusion argument has been fought. In the car.
Let me say that I don't think we need to pass that so quickly. Because here you have a different situation. It isn't like the wife suing the husband. If the wife sues the husband, then whatever is recovered, I know there are some parts, but most of what's recovered belongs to the wife as her separate property. And therefore, you can make some argument there that since it is her property, then you have to take that. But remember, the things that the child is going to recover, for instance, medical bills, the father is responsible for those. The earning capacity of the child, that belongs to the father. It doesn't belong to the child. It belongs to the father under the payment period. The past earnings, loss of past earnings, belong to the father. Whatever monies that are collected that don't belong to the father are things that are going to be under the father's supervision and control. The father would even inherit them if the child died.
Well, an ordinary minor injury, in a case that does not cause permanent injuries, what we really may be talking about here is a shifting of which insurance policy comes into effect. I mean, that's possible if the insurance commission changes the basic policy. But in a catastrophic injury case, we are talking about something entirely different. The child's earnings are not belong to the father after the child reaches the majority.
Well, that's right. Only up to 18.
I mean, we are talking about a situation where we are not holding a negligent party responsible for a duty to the world in certain circumstances for policy grounds. And what we have to do is examine that policy grounds in light of other existing policy grounds and see that they are in harmony. And there may be other reasons, but I'm searching for those reasons why this remains a viable, legitimate distinction in the development of the common law that this court should continue to recognize.
On the mirror side of that question, when I ask the opposing counsel, I'm asking him to answer. I would like an answer to the chief's question.
I put this to both sides equally.
As I understand your question, and let me just rephrase it in my way, because you expressed it much more eloquently than I can, but it was what has changed, in other words, in the parent-child relationship over those years that would justify a change in the policy. you know what my answer is going to be. I don't think there have been changes. If there have been changes, I think the changes have essentially been in the other direction. Under the old statute involving the parent-child relationship, although we didn't call it that, there were practically no rules.
all of them are judicially made rules and so on as to what the parent-child relationship contained. In 1974, Title II of the Family Code came into effect, and it essentially lays out what the parent-child relationship is, what the rights, duties, powers, privileges, so on, are all laid out. And I think those things were, in the writing of the code, primarily taken out of the old cases. I think all of those things have essentially, whatever change there has been to more institutionalize them, more make them a part of the statute, and to recognize those things. I think since all of that came about, Stanley versus Illinois was written by the United States Supreme Court saying that the parent-child relationship is one of a constitutional dimension. This court in NRAGN held that the parent-child relationship is one of constitutional dimension. Those things had never been held before.
But what we have this litigation right now before us, it was a direct action. And it was a direct action, child, father's insurance company. What this litigation would be?
Well, I'm sorry.
It was a direct action. You had direct action.
Depends on what kind of context you're talking about. One thing that Mr. Simic said is that negligence is not disputed. It certainly is disputed. I think if you look at the deposition, you'll see that it is. If it were an action based upon negligence, it would be disputed. If it were an action based upon an insurance policy which insured benefits, medical benefits, or whatever that was not based upon negligence, then we would not be here.
You want to orate?
I do not want to orate. Y'all are finished.
Oh, what public policy, family policy would be served by allowing a child to sue a parent?
I certainly think none. One of the, I'm sure that came as no surprise. But let me tell you one of the things that perhaps bothers me the most in this whole thing. It's a kind of a conflict of interest in the thing. If I stood up here before you and said that if I lose this case, I get control over $115,000. Every one of you would rise up in arms and say, hey, you have a conflict of interest. You ought not to be up here representing somebody when losing gains you $115,000. But in this case, if Ahmad Jalani loses, he gains control over $115,000. So they get everything they have.
Is that what they pled for or what?
Yes, that's what they pled for.
But couldn't the trial court cure that and put it in the guardianship and order someone else to handle it, not the father?
Could. But that doesn't cure it. See, what that does is put the control in somebody else. But that means the father is going to... Those things he's not going to have to furnish, which he would have been furnished otherwise. But I would make that deal with you. If you wanted to contribute to my son $115,000 and wanted to put somebody else in control of it, I'd make that deal with you.
Well, would you ask your insurance company for a reduction in your premium if it didn't cover after you'd already paid the premium?
Well, that's assuming that you paid the premium for this in the first place, and since it's always been excluded, then I don't think you could say that that has been included in any premium. Since the parental immunity doctrine is alive and well as of today, and tomorrow y'all might change things.
Policy on its face did not exclude coverage, did it?
No, but there are many things that the policy on its face does not exclude, that we do exclude, that you certainly wouldn't justify the insurance commission in taking into account.
When you sold Mr. Germani this policy, did you tell him that it wasn't going to cover injuries to his kids if he negligently injured them?
I did not sell him this policy.
Did your agent tell him?
My agent did not know.
That's a figure of speech, I take it. I don't...
Yes.
Somebody sold him the policy.
Yes, and I understand the question, but I think it is very important for me to understand, and I try to always understand, that I represent Mr. Jelani. I do not represent an insurance company. And you all would be very critical of me and probably would hold me liable if I tried to represent the insurance company, not Mr. Jelani.
Well, I don't think we're here to revisit Tilly. Maybe we are. But would you say that if this court change the law in this area, it would put a defense counsel in an impossible position? Is that what I hear you saying?
Oh, yes. Oh, for instance, what would happen, it has not happened, I can assure you, but what would happen if Mr. Jelani walked in and said, I am not negligent, but I demand that you pay the policy limit?
Well, I mean, what you're saying is we require the lawyer paid by the insurance company to represent the insurer's best interest in each and every case as the primary duty, and that, in your opinion, the insurer's best interest would always be to lose the case?
No. But I'm saying that you certainly have a problem at that point.
Well, can you justify how Mr. Jelani would be better off by winning this case?
Well, simply because most of us would at least say, I'm not sure whether we are saying it in truth or not, that we don't want to be held liable, even if it means we lose money.
Well, you know, it's hard for me to distinguish between a father who drives down the road and negligently injures his own child and a case in which that same child, if he were riding in the neighbor's car, and the neighbor negligently injured him, the child could recover. The child may have permanent injuries. Let's suppose he's a quadriplegic as a result of this wreck. Why shouldn't the child be made whole as far as money can make him whole, whether he's riding in the neighbor's car as a passenger or riding in his own father's car as a passenger?
His father already has that duty.
Nobody bought the insurance because he thought that that was going to take care of any wreck he might have where he might have negligently injured anybody. And he paid a premium for it.
I cannot say what motivated people in buying insurance or that they thought that it was covered by an insurance policy. I think that if you were to decide tomorrow, if you would put in the headlines of the paper tomorrow, the headlines, Supreme Court decides children can sue parents, that people would be surprised as a general rule. Therefore, I don't think you can really say that a parent buys an insurance policy thinking that if their child is injured, that the liability portion of that policy is going to cover that. And I don't know. Each individual, I guess, would have different thoughts when they bought insurance policies. I can speak only for me. I know I didn't think I was covering those things. Now, with the personal injury protection, I thought I was covering those. I'm sorry, Mr. Robinson, I didn't hear
you. I said you had a strong argument.
Any other questions? Thank you very much.
Just spirit, if I might first go ahead and answer the question you posed, please. Yes, I do believe there are policy reasons, and I think they're not only public policy reasons, but I think there are changes that take place in our society
that justify looking at this. I think all of us recognize that 20 years ago, and certainly 50 or 60 years ago, family circle and family union was basically confined or restricted to, for lack of a better word, all that household. At least I know it wasn't my own situation. And things centered around eating dinner at the supper table, centered around having lunch if you weren't at school, having breakfast every morning. I don't know about your particular situation, but for my four kids, I know that I'm lucky if I get to eat breakfast with them in the morning. I mean, they're going to band, or going to the piano classes early in the morning, or whatever else, making school projects of it. I very seldom, if ever, get to eat lunch with them, even when they're out of school, because they're in some activity. They're moving around. And at dinner is about our only time that we can get together. And that's even complicated by the dance and the tennis and the band and everything else. And I think that just reflects how mobile our society has become and how we have had to change and adapt to that mobility. So I think there's a distinct difference between what was occurring in 1891 and what's occurring in 1988.
I agree with that. My question is, how does that change in mobility affect the necessity of maintaining family relationships?
I don't believe it changes the necessity of maintaining a family relationship. I think that's a necessity. I think that it changes in the respect that we are mobile, and as a result, new things have arisen that didn't exist in 1891. You know, we didn't drive cars, and we didn't go traveling across the state, at least I understand that we didn't, back that many years ago. We did, it was very few cars. We didn't have, as I understand it, insurance as we have the concept now. We didn't have mandatory insurance, as the state of Texas has. We didn't have all these licenses procedures for people operating. We didn't have, set out as Mr. Perkins decided, various laws that define the duties of the parent to do A, B, C, and D. We have all those now. And as we have developed, we have set higher standards and higher requirements. And I think public policy, as a result of that, says at this point in time that all of us, including the child, should have the opportunity of redress for a wrong. And parental unity doctrine, as it was developed earlier, didn't contemplate that. Our policy, our public at this time, does contemplate it, and I think that's the biggest thing here.
Please understand, I'm not trying to be argumentative. I'm really trying to pull from you your concept why we should abolish a rule that's been there for 100 years. What is the change? What I've gotten from you is that cars now exist. And parental duties have changed. Is that the reason we should change the rule?
I think those are part of them. I think the other one that I was listening, which I think is very important, is I think that public policy dictates that we afford a child the opportunity to redress for a wrong, even if it's against his father. And that has been recognized by our courts in many, many cases.
That hasn't changed, though, since 1890.
I think it has, Your Honor. I think
But in 1890, you had the right to action to the insurance company, didn't you, as a third-party beneficiary? Up until 1931, is that correct?
I'll take your word for it. I'm not sure. I agree with you.
But what I think what you're trying to say is that if there's a neighbor's child in this car, and the father's child, if the neighbor's child could sue Mr. Chiron at this point in time, possibly recover if he was married. But if Mr. Chiron's child does not have a cause of action, unless there's some sort of,
I think that's
unless we create some sort of third party beneficiary, which is really a subterfuge. So you're really trying to seek a recovery against an insurance company, aren't you?
Yes, sir.
Not against the father.
That's a fair statement of the bottom line.
That's the bottom line. You're not really seeking a recovery against the child is not really seeking recovery against the father. They're trying to seek recovery against the father's insurance company, isn't it?
I think he's trying
to have this subterfuge of not allowing direct action.
And I can't argue with that because I think, again, the very bottom line is that your child is seeking his recovery through the mother,
I would be very surprised if the child received a recovery in excess of the limits, but if any action is taken against the parents. And in that regard, I think that statement is correct.
In that regard, would you object to a ruling that if we were to abolish the doctrine of parental immunity, that the amount of recovery be limited to the amount of existing applicable insurance?
At first glance, I would not object to that limitation. I haven't thought of cases where it might apply.
You made the whole point, though, that you're not really after trying to punish the parent. You're after the redress, which is usually covered by insurance. I'm asking you, are you willing to limit the recovery to the amount of applicable insurance?
I think that's fair trade.
Then if a father has been unable to secure insurance, then he has immunity?
I don't know that that's correct. One of the things that the Respondent's Brief talks about is that we should all go out and buy all this insurance. Disability insurance and pay a premium for that. Go out and buy medical insurance and pay a premium for that. Buy personal injury protection, which they limit to the amount you can buy, and just pay for that.
And homeowners.
Their argument is we should buy all these kinds of insurance. There are people who can't buy all those kinds of insurance. And in that respect, I think it's wrong to limit the immunity of the parent on purely basis of whether he has or does not have insurance. I think the child should have the right that everyone else has to bring a suit against the parent for a wrong decision that we're talking about. And if I may, a friend asked me, and I'll give you an example. He said, you mean if I was driving a car, and my wife was riding with me, and my daughter was riding with me, and I had my mother in the car, and I had a little baby child riding with my girl, and my girl was there, that if I had a wreck and it was my fault, the only person in that car under the current law that could sue me is my own daughter? And I said, that's the way I understand the law. He said, my mom can sue me, my wife can sue me, my neighbor can sue me, and my child can. He said, why did I purchase insurance? And I think that is the general feeling of the public as a whole. I disagree with Mr. Purdom in with respect to what we as people believe we can share with insurance. I think he said that he does not believe that when you purchase insurance, you think you're covered. I think that the person who purchased that insurance, the representation made by the company, he assumed that everybody was covered including his child. And I submit if he read that policy as it existed and as it's in this particular file and talks about covered person, there's no question. And I would submit to the court that very, very few people understand or have any knowledge about what we call the parental immunity doctrine or have any concept that their one child did not bring the suit. And I just differ with Mr. Ferdinand on that belief. I would also like to make an answer with respect to the money and this idea of conflict of interest and that the parent is enriched by it. We have statutes that provide when monies are recovered by minor children, that money be put in the court, and that it be taken out of the court registry under certain restrictions. And I certainly believe that a court is going to use its best judgment and discretion in protecting the child's money. I don't believe the parent is going to go and pull all that money out of the registry of the court and, through some attorney representing that particular guardian, try to fool the court and take the money out and use it for himself. It's been my experience in all of the minor cases that I've had and all of the ones that are still existing. And every year I file an annual accountings in the courts of our county for minors of justice. The court watches and preserves that money. And I've seen many, many children, not money garnered from a parent, but money that was garnered in their minority from another source, attain their age of 18 and then have money for them to go to school on, to go to college, to redress them for that gift that he's going to walk around with the rest of his life. And I also disagree with Mr. Purdom, or take exception, that it ends when he's 18. It doesn't, particularly in very serious injuries. It's a lifelong commitment. And I think the child is entitled to recover that just as any other person is to go wrong. With respect respect to the two questions about conflict and collusion, I think the court of this state, of all of our states, has addressed this idea of collusion. And I think that that is something that's aside the board. I just really don't believe that our system will let that pass through without being corrected. With respect to the conflict, certainly the mere fact that this child was injured in this wreck, the mere fact that he lay in that hospital and went through the surgery, the fact that he suffered that pain, the fact that he's got that to live with the rest of his life, I think it speaks the point to say that that hasn't created conflict, if you want to use that word, in the familial relationship. But that child's bringing suit now, I don't think creates any more conflict than the other, if that's the point that's been made. Petitioners respectfully request that because of the nature of this case, because of the policy considerations, that we don't let children in a situation where, before the phrase I've heard before, justice is delayed, is justice denied, that we don't let children sit here and say, well, we're going to keep this doctrine in place, and you wait around until you're 18. Now, we recognize by our statute of limitations that we encourage the bringing of these suits within 2 years because the facts get old and the facts get stale and parties leave, etc. We're not going to pay attention to that for an immunity doctrine. We're just going to block it for your 18. I suggest to the court, and we request the court to consider that, that this minor child, or any minor children, should not be delayed in bringing a suit to redress the wrong done to them. Delaying their right to bring this suit until they're 18 is not justice to them.
Counsel, I'm confused here. I thought if the doctrine was one of immunity, she couldn't bring the suit either as a child by an ex-friend or any time in the future. It's not a matter of tolling the disability until they're 18, and then they can bring the suit. They can't ever bring the suit, as I understand. Is that correct or not? You keep talking about, you know, why make them wait till they're 18? I don't think they can bring it even after they're 18 if there's immunity. Am I wrong on that thing?
Well, I believe that's wrong, Your Honor. I'm under the impression, and I thought the Sneed case also talked about it, that the immunity we're talking about is until they're 18, and that
Well, that's 18, partially so. For property damage, the child waits until it reaches majority and then can sue for property damage.
That's correct, and also for contractual.
On personal injury, just because a child reaches 18, are you saying that it revives a cause of action the child never had?
No, I'm saying that the child should not, for an immunity doctrine, be restricted until he's 18 to be able to bring the suit to try to redress the wrong.
Well, but as Justice Spears pointed out, are you saying that the child somehow is given the right to sue a parent after he reaches 18 to correct this charge?
Oh, yeah.
But nobody's ever tried that, have
they? I don't believe it's been tried. I have not seen any cases on that point. I've not been involved in one.
Counsel, you cited this a case out of Iowa, deal against deal.
Yes, sir.
Or dial against dial. You didn't give us a cite to that, I don't believe.
I'm sorry, I thought I did it on you. Well,
you did, I didn't get it. You might want to submit a little letter brief for pointing it out to us and what it says, but I don't believe it.
That would be helpful if you just write a letter brief with enough copies for each of us. Would you cite the case or anything else, any other authorities? And first, of course,
have you done any research on how many states have abolished direct action, indirect action?
I don't know how many have abolished. I know in the readings of the cases it talks about, in a number of cases, that the doctrine has no application because there's a direct action. But I can't tell you any number.
Can you point us to an ALR article?
No, the most recent ALR article that I've read, Your Honor, is in ALR court, and I'll have to give you the fact of that also.
All right. You'll do that in the letter, please.
Yes, sir.
Allow counsel to reply.
Thank you, Your Honor.
All right.
Just so we'll have some time deadlines, can you get a letter brief in a week and council will reply in another week? Thank you very much. The court will now take a brief recess.